Is your vehicle stopping like it should? Does it squeal or grind when you brake? Don't miss out on summer brake deals at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
In August of 1928, a woman from a tiny town in Missouri was arrested on two counts of first-degree murder. As you might imagine, the arrest of a 56-year-old woman with a reputation as a nurse and a healer in the community where she lived wasn't your run-of-the-mill news story in the late 1920s. It was a shocking event to people who lived in nearby St. Louis, but those from Franklin County, where the woman lived, weren't as surprised. Some of them even wondered what had taken the police so long. They were all aware that this angel of mercy had a history of caring for people who suddenly became sick and died. It's just that no one who was able to do anything seemed to care. The story of how that woman, Bertha Gifford, had gotten away with her crimes for so long is bizarre, to say the least. What's equally curious is that she was one of the most infamous criminals in the history of the state, and yet so few people who live in Missouri today are even aware of her story. Or that the place where she once lived and worked was once considered to be a couple of the most haunted places in the region. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. This season, we're on a cross-country trip in search of America's murder houses, relics of time and crimes gone by. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder and violence has left lingering ghosts behind. In this episode, we're going to dive deep into the story of Bertha Gifford, one of the deadliest female serial killers in history, but one that few people know about. This is a story guaranteed to give you chills, and to make sure you check the ingredients for any meal offered to you by the kind woman who lives on the farm next door. Bertha Alice Williams was born in 1872, just outside a small, unincorporated community called Morse Mill. The village, located about 40 miles south of St. Louis, had grown up around a house and a grain mill owned by John H. Morse. The house, built in 1916, would later be turned into a hotel where Bertha lived and worked for a time. The Williams family were some of the first settlers in the area. Bertha's parents, W.P. and Matilda Williams, had 10 children, although two died in infancy, which of course was why farmers in the 19th century had so many kids in the first place. Bertha was the ninth child to be born. The family was well respected and belonged to a fundamentalist Christian sect known as the Church of God, Faith of Abraham. They were a devout sect that believed the Bible was meant to be taken literally. The world was 6,000 years old, it had been washed clean by a flood, that kind of thing. They also believed in peace and that no Christian should ever commit violence or cause harm to others, even during times of war. Well, Bertha didn't learn much from her church's message of peace and redemption, but she did learn that caring for the sick was good for the soul, or at least it was a good way to get attention. She grew up to be an exceptionally beautiful young woman and was often called the prettiest girl in the county. She had long dark hair and a bright smile. She loved music, loved to dance, and was very social, which attracted young men from all over the area to her parents' door. And she loved the attention they gave her. On December 20th, 1894, at the age of 22, Bertha married a man named Henry Graham. He'd been born in Morse Mill in 1872, and his family had been in the area for generations. Henry had three sisters and four brothers, one of which, Peter, had recently committed suicide by swallowing carbolic acid. but that was about the only bad thing anyone had to say about the family. Bertha and Henry were an attractive and happy couple. Together, they ran the hotel in Morse Mill, which was really more of a boarding house than what we think of as a hotel today. And in July 1896, they had a daughter and they named Lila. They had the appearance of an ideal family, even though by 1900, they were living with Bertha's brother, Albert. Henry was working as Albert's farmhand, and Bertha was cooking and keeping house for the family. Something had happened to cause a change of fortunes, but what it might have been remains a mystery. What we do know, though, was that Henry started seeing another woman. But Bertha, still a beautiful woman in her own right, wasted little time worrying about her husband's infidelity. Instead, she started spending time with Eugene Gifford, a young man 7 years younger than she was. He fell in love with Bertha and broke off his engagement to another young woman. Eugene was a strapping farmer and carpenter with thick brown hair and blue eyes. At nearly 6 feet tall, he was almost a foot taller than Bertha and was clearly head over heels about her. Their relationship, as well as Henry's affair, became a badly kept secret in the community. But the Graham marital drama came to an abrupt halt when Henry became seriously ill. He was initially diagnosed with pneumonia, and Bertha's anger with him seemed to fade away. She refused to leave his side, nursing him around the clock as Henry's condition became worse. He died in agony on November 30th, 1906, suffering from terrible stomach pain, which is, by the way, not a symptom of pneumonia. Doctors shrugged this off, though, and no one questioned their findings. He was buried in the cemetery in Morse Mill near the graves of his parents. In 1907, after a respectable mourning period, Bertha married Eugene Gifford, and the couple moved to neighboring Franklin County, just far enough away to escape the gossips in Morse Mill. Lila moved there with her mother, but in 1914, she married Ernest West and moved to Detroit. She lived until 1978, probably because she was so far away from her mother. Well, in Franklin County, the Giffords moved into a small house in the tiny rural community of Catawissa, which only had about 150 people living there when they arrived. There was no grocery store or eatery, so if anyone needed anything, they went to the slightly larger town of Pacific. Eugene began farming again, and after a successful season, he and Bertha moved to a white farmhouse on Old Bend Road, overlooking the Merrimack River. It was in this house where Bertha would probably poison 9 of her victims. But before people started dying, the Giffords had a fine reputation. The neighbors, other families who lived along Old Bend Road, were tightly knit and welcoming. Everybody liked Eugene. He was a hard worker and had a great sense of humor. He ran the farm, and Bertha, who fed the hired hands, became beloved for her incredible cooking. Her biscuits were things of beauty, admirers said, and her potato soup was the best in the county. She was happy to have neighbors over for supper, and she often brought food to other families when someone in the household was ill. Well, this was the beginning of her reputation as a country nurse who cared for the injured and the sick. Of course, the seed of this had already been planted a few years before when her first husband, Henry, had become sick. Bertha had cared for him until the very end. People praised her for her devotion to a man who'd abandoned her for another woman, and they shared her sadness when he died. Bertha, of course, had delighted in the attention she'd gotten, serving as Henry's nurse, and it's possible that her boredom living in Catawissa led her back to her amateur nursing again. At first, her bedside care was little more than a comforting presence and a cold cloth on a fevered brow. Soon, though, she was treating people with what she called her potions. What was in them was unknown, but she had a different one for headaches, insomnia, fevers, or whatever else was ailing you. She carried them with her in her black medical bag whenever she visited a sick neighbor. Bertha had no medical training or even skills with herbs. She was making things up as she went along. However, in a small rural community, when the closest doctor was many miles and many hours away, she was a kind-hearted angel of mercy. She was known to walk or ride for miles to help a sick or injured person. She always remained calm and collected during an emergency and never flinched when stitching or bandaging even the most gruesome farm injury. What was running through Bertha's mind as she began ministering to her neighbors on their sick beds remains another mystery. We'll never know if she was insane or simply evil, but we do know that from 1912 and into the 1920s, many of her patients, including several children, died from unknown causes. The dead were neighbors, friends, even relatives, but few people, if any, thought the deaths were suspicious at first. What seemed to be the Giffords' happy life continued along Old Ben Road. Then in 1911, Eugene invited his widowed mother, Emily, and his little brother, James, to come and live with them on the farm. Bertha was warm and welcoming, and the new arrivals soon learned to love both Bertha and her fabulous cooking. Apparently, even though she didn't know it, Emily wore out her welcome within a few months. Near the end of the year, she became violently ill, suffering from vomiting and intense stomach cramps. Her health declined and she died on January 24, 1912. With Eugene racked with grief, Bertha took care of the funeral arrangements. It would be the first of many funerals that Bertha would attend. She put on her finest mourning dress and began a tradition of always speaking at the funerals of the poor souls who died under her care. Eugene's brother, James, continued to live at the farm on Old Ben Road for another year, but on May 12, 1913, the 12-year-old boy became very sick, first suffering from severe stomach pains, like his mother, and then he died. His death certificate would read that he had died due to, quote, strangulation due to accumulation of mucus with inability to expectorate. In other words, he choked to death on his own snot. The secondary cause of death was whooping cough. Now, it's very possible that Bertha had nothing to do with James's death. The symptoms listed on his death certificate don't match those with any kind of poisoning, but it's hard to ignore that he was first weakened by stomach cramps and vomiting. He might have already been sick when, or if, he was poisoned. If he already had whooping cough, it wouldn't have taken much to finish him off. In 1915, Bernard Stuhlfelder, a 15-month-old son of the Giffords' closest neighbors, George and Martha Stuhlfelder, became ill with pneumonia. Bertha immediately offered to help the young family. She tended to Bernard for a few days before complications occurred. The little boy began screaming and writhing in his crib with stomach pains. After 3 days of this, Bernard mercifully died. His parents were grateful to Bertha for trying to help him and sang her praises to other neighbors, even as they buried their young son. One night in 1917, the Giffords had an unwelcome visitor, a relative of Eugene's named Sherman Pounds. He showed up that night on their doorstep so drunk he could barely stand. Sherman was otherwise a decent fella. He was well-liked, funny, and at 53, was a widower who cared for 5 young children. He took care of his family, but on weekends, he liked to drink. A lot. Bertha was not happy to see him. She helped Eugene get him into bed, and she mixed a tonic for him that would ease the terrible hangover he was bound to have in the morning. But Sherman never saw the sunrise. In the middle of the night, he began screaming in pain, suffering from terrible stomach cramps. He was dead a few hours later. Dr. W.H. Hemker, the only physician for miles, declared that Sherman had died from alcohol poisoning. While neighbors sadly shook their heads at Sherman's funeral, it was only a matter of time before something like this happened, they said. His heavy drinking just couldn't continue. He'd never been the same since the death of his wife. About 8 months later, Jim Ogle, a farmhand who worked for the Giffords, began squabbling with Eugene over unpaid wages. He became sick, a short time later. Dr. Hemker diagnosed his illness as malaria. And of course, Bertha offered to nurse Jim back to health. On November 17, 1917, Bertha traveled to Pacific to do her monthly shopping. She stopped in at the drugstore and told the pharmacist that rats were biting her chickens and stealing eggs. So he sold her a package of rat poison to deal with the problem. It was a common, ordinary item at the time, but because it was made with arsenic, Bertha had to sign a poison registry to purchase it. She must have believed she was above suspicion because she signed it with her own name and left the store with a very dangerous poison. Well, the next day, Jim Ogle's illness suddenly got much worse. He began complaining of sharp stomach pains. Dr. Hemker was called once again and explained the stomach pains were another symptom of malaria. And he was right. Stomach pains, nausea, and diarrhea can all be symptoms of malaria, but a high fever always accompanies them. Jim didn't have one. He suffered for two more days before he died on November 20th. Dr. Hemker's cause of death? Acute gastritis. Yep, he had a stomach ache. In 1918, a 9-year-old girl named Beulah Pounds also died from acute gastritis. Her parents, Jesse and Marguerite Pounds, had taken her to Bertha for care. It didn't help. Another area doctor named Parker signed the death certificate this time. That same year, Margaret, the 2-year-old daughter of George and Francis Stuhlfelder, whose son Bernard had died under Bertha's care in 1915, well, she came down with pneumonia. They summoned Dr. Hemker to treat her, and he prescribed a medication for her, but it didn't do anything to help. So when Margaret's condition got worse, they turned to Bertha, who immediately came to the house with her bag of tonics. She gravely explained that Margaret was desperately ill and unlikely to recover, but would do her best to care for the toddler anyway. She remained next to the little girl's bed for 2 days, and then Margaret suddenly began crying in pain and vomited uncontrollably. She died the next morning, on February 28, 1921. Dr. Hemker listed the cause of death as, you guessed it, acute gastritis. On December 26, 1922, Bertha was caring for another little girl while her mother was away on a shopping trip in Pacific. Ironically, her name was also Beulah Pounds. She was a relative of the girl who had died under Bertha Gifford's care in 1918. And she was also the granddaughter of Sherman Pounds, the guy who'd supposedly died at the Giffords' home from alcohol poisoning the year before. By the time that Beulah's mother, Essie, returned from her trip, the little girl was crying because her stomach hurt so badly. Bertha offered to care for the girl overnight, and Essie agreed. She sat next to Beulah's bed for the next 12 hours, but by morning, the girl was much worse. Her panicked mother sent for Dr. Hemker, but the child was dead by the time he arrived. Bertha described Beulah's symptoms to the physician, and he once again listed acute gastritis as the cause of death. Beulah wasn't buried until January 5, 1923. Her aunt had insisted on a postmortem for the child. She seemed to be the only person that thought it was suspicious that another child from the same family had died from the exact same ailment while also under Bertha's care. However, Dr. Hemker dismissed the idea of foul play, and Bertha was furious that anyone would suspect that she caused the little girl's death when she'd only been trying to help. Essie Pounds would later tell a local newspaper, "My sister thought things looked pretty funny because my father also died in Mrs. Gifford's house after he was taken with acute stomach pains there. Mrs. Gifford was usually a quiet woman, but she sure got mad, and she said terrible things." The death caused a rift between Bertha and the Pounds family, which is not exactly shocking news, and they excluded her from the funeral. It was the only funeral in Katowice that Bertha missed. Now, remember the Stuhlfelder family with the two dead kids? Well, in 1923, a third one, Irene, who was seven, also became sick. According to her mother, Frances, Irene had been having trouble with worms for a few years. She wasn't afraid of them. She had them. Worms. Like, inside her. I guess this was a thing in rural areas back then. Listen, I'll be right back. I need to go throw up. Anyway, the family called Dr. Hemker, who does not strike me as being all that competent, I gotta say. And he had some stomach powder for her. Irene seemed to be getting better until Bertha came by to check on her. She soon took a turn for the worse and began vomiting and complaining of stomach cramps. She lingered for 9 days before she died. Now, this was the third child in the same family that had died under Bertha's care. When a grand jury later asked Frances Stuhlfelder if she was troubled by this, she shrugged. "We didn't think anything strange about the death of our children. Everyone in this part of the country knows that Mrs. Gifford has a wide reputation as a nurse." Two years passed quietly, and then in June 1925, a neighbor of the Giffords named Ethel Shamel became sick. Ethel and her husband George were, by all appearances, close friends with Eugene and Bertha. They were even related to them, cousins somewhere down the line. George often helped Eugene around the farm, and the couples often had supper together. When Ethel became ill, Bertha, of course, offered to nurse her back to health. And then, not surprisingly, a few days later, Ethel died. She was only 33 years old. About 2 months later, Ethel and George's son, Lloyd, also died. Now, his death was a shock. He was 9 years old and in fine health, until he spent the night at the Gifford house. 2 months after that, his 7-year-old brother Elmer also died while under Bertha's care. And then a month after that, George's sister Leona also became sick. She was confined to her bed with stomach pains and vomiting, and then Bertha quickly stepped in to care for her. And then Leona died 2 days later. She was 37. Dr. Hemker, yeah, this guy again, signed all 4 of the Shamel death certificates, but this time he did it a little more reluctantly. Up until this point, he seemed to be completely clueless, inexperienced, or both, but now he was starting to wonder about what was going on. He'd recommended an autopsy after Elmer Shamel had died, but George wouldn't agree to it. Deciding not to press the issue, he cited the cause of death on Elmer's death certificate as acute unknown disease and acute gastritis. This wording was close to what he'd written on the death certificates of some of Bertha's previous patients, but not quite the same. Too many people had died, and Bertha Gifford had been around all of them. Even this guy was starting to think that something wasn't right, and he wasn't the only one. After the Shamel deaths, Bertha's neighbors had started to whisper. Mortality rates were high in rural Missouri in the 1920s, but come on, not that high. Almost all the people who had died had been healthy and strong one day and seriously ill the next. And most died at Eugene and Bertha Gifford's house. Rumors spread, and a few people even wrote anonymous letters to Franklin County prosecuting attorney Frank Jenny, urging an investigation, but no action was taken. He either didn't see the letters or he dismissed them. Bertha was safe. For now, anyway. Now, during Prohibition, Eugene, like so many others in the rural county, kept a still in his barn to make homemade liquor. It was good quality, and he sold off the excess to neighbors and townsfolk, which earned the Giffords a little extra money. Eugene had a friend named Gus Unnerstall who helped him with distribution. At some point, Gus and Eugene got into an argument over money, and it became so heated that Bertha ended up running Gus off the property with a butcher's knife. Gus came back a few days later, regretful and ashamed and blaming the argument on sampling too much of their supply, but Bertha didn't want his apology. Before he could get out of his truck, she was on the porch with a knife in her hand. She told him that if he set foot on her property, she'd cut him up into pieces. Gus called the sheriff and Bertha was arrested, but no charges were filed against her. Then in 1926, Gus's mother, Clementine, became sick, and Bertha offered to care for her. Now, one might think that Gus would be leery of letting a woman who threatened to kill him take care of his mother, especially with gossip going around about Bertha and suspicious deaths, but he wasn't. He just assumed that Bertha had forgiven him for their recent dispute. But she hadn't. Clementine died on February 9th, just days after Bertha started nursing her. Her death certificate stated the cause of death was heart failure. Things were quiet until early 1927, when Prohibition agents dropped in at the farm and destroyed Eugene Still. He was arrested and fined for the illegal operation, but didn't spend any time in jail. Bertha, though, was outraged. When the agents had first shown up, she tried to chase them off the farm with a shotgun, but this wasn't like scaring away a local farm boy. Federal agents took their job a bit more seriously. Even so, Bertha insisted that Eugene had done nothing wrong. Times were tough, and he was only trying to make ends meet. Everyone in the county, most of whom made their own liquor, felt the same way. Well, the fine was a financial blow for the couple, and Bertha remained angry about it. Bertha's next victim, next patient, literally ended up on her doorstep on May 15th, 1927. One of Eugene's farmhands, 49-year-old Ed Brindley, became falling down drunk that evening, and he fell down on the Giffords' front porch. Eugene and Bertha managed to get him into the house and put him into the spare bedroom to sleep it off. And when Brindley woke up the following day, Bertha gave him some homemade lemonade to help with his hangover. But his headache was quickly forgotten when he began experiencing stabbing stomach pains. A few hours later, he died in agony. Dr. Hemker was called but was nervous about recording another death as acute gastritis, so he summoned a second doctor from Pacific for his opinion. They couldn't agree on a cause of death, so Hemker again wrote down acute unknown disease and acute gastritis on the death certificate. Bertha took charge of Brindley's funeral arrangements and had his body picked up by the local undertaker. Ed's estranged wife was unhappy about this and arranged to have the man's body taken to Pacific instead. The undertaker there, John Thebes Jr., did excellent work. And the high quality of that work would later come back to haunt Bertha Gifford. After Ed Brindley's death, tongues started wagging again, and more anonymous letters were sent to the prosecutor, urging an investigation into Bertha's actions, and maybe those of Dr. Hemker, too. In hindsight, it almost looks as if Dr. Hemker was Bertha's accomplice, covering up for her murders, but this wasn't the case. I assumed he was just stupid, but apparently Hemker did suspect Bertha of poisoning people, but was unable to prove it. He was a simple country doctor with little formal training. He'd never seen anyone poisoned before. After Bertha was eventually arrested, he told the authorities he hadn't made accusations against Bertha because he feared she would sue him for libel. And of course, she also, had that knife. Well, it turned out that Dr. Hemker wasn't the only one who felt that way. Others were also suspicious, but no one wanted to be the first to speak up. Ed Brindley turned out to be one strange death too many for the little community. Neighbors started looking at everything Bertha did with suspicion, but Bertha ignored the gossip. She came to Ed Brindley's funeral wearing her best black dress and quietly took charge of the proceedings, greeting the mourners as if Ed had been her husband and was not merely one of the Giffords' farmhands. As rumors about another death continued to spread, the prosecutor continued to ignore the situation. It finally took a newspaper reporter from St. Louis to get the authorities to act. After he received an anonymous letter, he came to the county to look around. After nosing around in town, he wrote a story naming at least five people who had died mysteriously while under Bertha Gifford's care. There were more, but that was a start. The suspicions about Bertha were finally a matter of public record. So in November of 1927, prosecutor Frank Jenny finally impaneled a grand jury to investigate Ed Brindley's death. And Bertha was again outraged. She told anyone who would listen that all she'd ever done was try to help people. She began threatening lawsuits against anyone who spoke against her. And Eugene remained loyal to her and helped her to harass people, even swearing at old friends in the middle of the street if they dared speak out against his wife. The Giffords managed to intimidate their neighbors to such an extent that no one was willing to testify against Bertha, and as a result, the grand jury failed to indict her. Finally, Bertha and Eugene moved to Eureka, Missouri, hoping to make a fresh start. However, her former neighbors, anonymously of course, kept up the pressure on Prosecutor Jenny, who impaneled another grand jury in August of 1928. Well, it was still an uphill battle, though. Everyone was too afraid to testify against Bertha, but things changed after Jenny managed to get the poison books from two pharmacies in Pacific. He now had hard evidence about how much arsenic Bertha had purchased since 1911. Each time she'd signed for it, she had written, "For rats." Once witnesses learned there was written proof to back up their suspicions, they were finally willing to talk. Frank Jenny had suspected that Bertha killed as many as 9 people, but after witnesses gathered their courage and came forward, he changed his mind. As the witnesses talked, Jenny cross-checked the mysterious deaths that he learned about with Bertha's purchases of poison. By the time he was done, Frank Jenny believed that Bertha Gifford had murdered 17 people, making her one of the most prolific female killers in American history. Bertha Gifford was indicted by the grand jury on August 23, 1928. Although Frank Jenny believed she'd killed many others, he felt he could only provide proof of 4 deaths, times when patients in her care died almost immediately after she'd bought poison. However, Bertha was only formally charged with 2 counts, the first-degree murders of Ed Brindley and 7-year-old Elmer Shamel. These were both recent cases and were fresh in the minds of his witnesses. Besides, Jenny would keep the other deaths as backup in case anything went wrong with Bertha's prosecution. He couldn't try her again for Ed and Elmer's murders, but he could certainly charge her with the others. Bertha was arrested in Eureka on the morning of August 25th by police detective Andrew McDonald. He allowed her to powder her face before he placed her in the car. He took her to the police station in Union, Missouri, where she was given a cup of tea and sat down to chat with Detective McDonald. And that's when she started talking. The conversation started off strange. She complained to McDonald about the rumors going around that claimed she'd killed Sherman and Beulah Pounds with poison. Well, she denied giving arsenic to Beulah, but did admit she'd given it to Ed Brindley and to Elmer and Lloyd Schmale to try and alleviate their pain. She hadn't done it to kill them, she said. And as strange as it sounds, that might have been the truth, or at least some version of it. Arsenic had been used throughout history as a medical treatment, although not in the size of dose that Bertha used. But then she got into trouble when she mentioned offhandedly that she might have given arsenic to a few other people too. Detective McDonald wrote down everything she said, and her statement was printed in the newspapers the following day. And it read,
"I, Bertha Gifford, hereby state of my own free will, without threat or promise of immunity, that my husband and I lived near Chattawissa about August 8, 1925, when George Shamel brought his son Lloyd, 9, and his son Elmer, about 7, to our house. Lloyd was sick at the time. Dr. Henker waited on him. I put some arsenic in his medicine before I gave it to him, and Lloyd died on August 31st. About September 8, 1925, Elmer took sick. Dr. Hemker was called and left some medicine for him, and I put arsenic in it, and Elmer John died about September 22nd. About May 15, 1927, Edward Brinley, 48, drove up to our house in an old Ford. He was drunk. He came in, sat down for a little while, then got up and went out and fell down on the concrete walk. My husband went out and brought him in and fixed the bed for him in the front room and laid him on the bed. His mother came over and insisted we call a doctor, so I called Dr. Hemker. He left some medicine for him, and I put some arsenic in the medicine. He died on May 16th. In all three cases, the patients were suffering from severe pains in the stomach, and I put arsenic in the medicine to quiet their pains.
When Bertha learned that her statement was in the newspaper, she was horrified. She frantically denied the confession, claiming that McDonald had made up the whole story. Well, Eugene, still convinced of his wife's innocence, loudly told everyone she'd been bullied into a false confession. He then quickly hired a prominent lawyer named James Booth to defend Bertha. In September, the court ordered the bodies of Ed Brinley and Lloyd Shamel to be exhumed. No autopsies had been conducted on the bodies, and Frank Jenny was confident in what a postmortem would reveal. The exams were conducted by Dr. Ralph Thompson, a nationally recognized pathologist from St. Louis. He removed the stomachs and livers for testing and found the stomach showed signs of distress, with ulcers and signs of an angry red rash. Considerable amounts of arsenic, much more than merely any kind of medicinal amount, were found in the livers of both bodies. While Bertha waited in jail for her trial, her legend grew. Stories spread about her behavior behind bars. There were stories that she was sleeping all day and performing strange rituals at night. One claimed she paced her cell all night and remarkably howled like a wolf and put curses on anyone who walked past her iron-barred cell window. After refusing to eat for 3 days, it was said that Bertha requested ice cream and wanted to wear a nurse's uniform while she ate it. The rumor went on to say she would only speak to Eugene and only while wearing that nurse's uniform. Well, that last story, that was actually true. Well, only the part about just speaking to Eugene. The rest of it wasn't. The others were just gossip or made up by reporters, but they were pretty entertaining back in 1928. Reporters began to refer to the Giffords' home on Old Bend Road as the House of Mystery. I mean, the neighbors never called it that. The newspapers just made it up, but it still managed to stick. People all over the area were finally talking. With Bertha behind bars, she couldn't sue anyone or chase them with a knife or a shotgun, so everyone wanted to tell their stories, and they all had one. And each usually ended with the neighbor saying, "I suspected her all along." But if that was true, then Bertha must have been a terrifying character to man, woman, and children alike. It seems hard to believe they could accept all that death and simply look the other way. Bertha's trial began on November 19, 1928. Crowds of reporters and curiosity seekers packed into the courthouse in Union, all eager to get a look at the defendant. A murder trial, especially involving a woman, was a rare thing in rural Missouri, and well, pretty much everyone wanted to be part of it. Defense attorney James Booth entered a plea of not guilty for his client, which Judge R.A. Bruner accepted. A jury was composed of 12 men, 8 farmers, a mail carrier, a shoe worker, a fruit dealer, and a restaurant owner. Bertha had originally been indicted for 2 murders, and then Elmer Shamel's murder was added after the prosecutor read Bertha's statement to Detective McDonald. By the time the trial started, though, Frank Jenny decided to try her for only the murder of Ed Brinley. This seems like a strange choice, since he'd probably have done better with the jury by bringing the murders of 2 children to trial, but perhaps Jenny was also keeping those 2 in reserve, just in case. Prosecutor Jenny began the proceedings by announcing in his opening statement he planned to seek the death penalty in the case. A parade of witnesses followed, which included a neighbor, Mary Grody, who didn't offer much that was incriminating, aside from hearing Bertha say she hoped Ed didn't die in her house. Now, I'd say that was understandable. When the days that followed, the prosecutor called Ed's estranged wife, Lou Delphia, and no, I'm not kidding, that was really her name, who hadn't seen him in 2 years, and Ed's mother, Mary, who loved her son, even though his drinking was so bad that it caused the family to lose the butcher shop they once owned. Ed had drunk away all the profits. She did tell the jury that when rumors had started about Ed's death being suspicious, Bertha had come to her and told her not to let the authorities dig up Ed's body. Frank Jenny also called the druggist from Pacific, William Powers, to the stand to testify he'd sold poison to Bertha and to confirm that it was her signature on the poison log. Bertha appeared to be unfazed by this damning testimony. She was cool, calm, and seemingly disinterested in what was going on. Dr. Hemker testified next. He refused to look at Bertha during his testimony, still intimidated by her. He stated that he found Ed Brindley in acute distress with stomach pains when he arrived at the Giffords' house. When asked by defense attorney James Booth whether Ed potentially sneaking alcohol after his medicinal lemonade could have made his stomach pain worse, Hemker agreed it was possible. However, he added the mix was probably not toxic. Good old Dr. Hemker, useless to the end. The doctors who performed Ed Brindley's autopsy, Dr. Ralph Thompson and Dr. Harry Bristow, took the stand and testified that the arsenic found in his body was enough to cause the man's death. Soon, Frank Jenny tried to enter Bertha's confession into evidence, which began a volatile exchange between the prosecutor and defense attorney. Booth insisted it was never intended to be a confession or an admission of murder. Bertha had just been trying to answer Detective McDonald's questions honestly. Well, things became so heated that the judge dismissed the jury for the day and called McDonald to the stand. He stated that he believed Bertha's statements were true, and so did his boss, Sheriff Gorg, although the sheriff seems to have had some odd ideas about medicine. He added to the judge that he felt Bertha, quote, attributed some mystical healing power to arsenic and gave it to patients without a sinister motive, unquote. That is not an opinion that was shared by the prosecutor, by Detective McDonald, or honestly, by me. Anyway, but the sheriff may not have been the only person who thought that in the 1920s. Doctors back then did, on occasion, give arsenic and strychnine, two deadly poisons, to patients as a heart stimulant. In fact, Dr. Hemker had done the same thing himself in the past. He even admitted to a reporter that because he felt the illnesses of Ed Brindley and the two children were suspicious, he refrained from giving them arsenic or strychnine so that he didn't, quote, didn't complicate the postmortem inquiry, unquote. In other words, he believed that Bertha was poisoning people. But he didn't want to confuse the autopsy by adding his own dose of poison to hers. Amazingly, Dr. Hemker was never charged with negligence and was allowed to continue to practice his medicine in the wake of Bertha's trial. I'm just glad that I was never his patient. Judge Bruner ultimately ruled that Bertha's confession could be admitted as evidence, which was a terrible blow to the defense. When the jury returned to the courtroom, the statement was read aloud to them. After a witness swore that he saw Bertha sign the confession, the prosecution rested its case. Eugene was the first to testify for the defense. Nervously, he claimed that Bertha had suffered from emotional trauma her entire life. She'd been suffering from terrible bouts of melancholy for at least 10 years and sometimes went days without sleeping, paced around the house, and refused to speak. Other times, she simply sat in a chair and stared silently at the wall for hours. Now, there was no question that Eugene's testimony had been coached by Bertha's attorney. Booth was now building an insanity defense. After a confession had been allowed into evidence, he knew there was no way of proving her innocent. Booth likely let Bertha in on his plan, because for the first time since the trial had started, she was listening intently as Eugene testified. Her knuckles were white as she pressed a clenched fist to her mouth. But she didn't need to worry about Eugene. He'd do anything to protect her. He described the day that Ed Brindley showed up at their house and his testimony rambled, which made the nervous man even more sympathetic to everyone in the courtroom. Booth called four more witnesses, each of them praising Bertha as a kind woman, but adding she was also nervous, excitable, and prone to depression. They'd also been coached to make Bertha sound as unstable as possible. After their testimony had concluded, Booth requested a recess to confer with the group of doctors he had arranged to testify about Bertha's state of mind. When court resumed, Booth changed Bertha's plea from not guilty to not guilty by reason of insanity. The judge agreed to the change, and Booth's doctors took the stand. Oddly, none of Booth's experts were psychiatrists. They were all local doctors, and it's assumed that Booth thought this would make them more credible to the jury. It was their conclusion that Bertha was suffering from dementia praecox, which was something of a catch-all term for insanity caused by old age. The doctors used Bertha's morbid behavior, her obsession with death, funerals, and illness, as proof of her condition. Now, in hindsight, this seems ridiculous. Not only were none of Booth's doctors experts on mental illness, but they failed to explain why, if Bertha was suffering from dementia caused by her age, she'd started poisoning her victims many years earlier. Frank Jenny brought his own doctors to the stand. They were actual experts, psychiatrists who had met Bertha when they were called to consult on the case. Jenny had obviously hoped they would find her sane and guilty of her crimes, but calling the two psychiatrists to the stand turned out to be a misstep. They examined Bertha and both declared that she was unquestionably of unsound mind and suffering from chronic paranoia. She was, they stated, incurable. Bertha never took the stand. She was leaving it to the jury to decide her fate. They returned to the courtroom after just 3 hours of deliberation. It seemed that 11 of them had voted not guilty, but one crotchety old farmer wanted to see her punished, so the judge sent him out again. They returned a little after 10 p.m., this time with a verdict. Bertha was found not guilty by reason of insanity, insanity from which she had not recovered. Bertha had no visible reaction to the verdict. Even after the judge ordered that she be remanded to a hospital for the criminally insane for the rest of her life. Eugene whispered something in her ear when she was led away, but what words he spoke remain another mystery. A mystery among many others in this story. No motive was ever discovered for the killings. There were rumors that the Giffords had profited from some of the deaths, but this wasn't true. Bertha didn't even charge the sick people that she cared for who became well. One of the doctors who found her insane stated that she might have believed she was doing good by ending the suffering of the sick and sending them on to heaven. It was never suggested that Bertha might be simply evil, a sadistic killer who relished taking the lives of those under her control. In 1928, it was unthinkable that a woman might be capable of such cruelty and depravity. Well, today we know better, but is that why Bertha committed murder? No one knows. Bertha was sent to State Hospital No. 4, located in Farmington, Missouri. Eugene visited regularly for a while, but he eventually realized that she was in the asylum to stay. He divorced Bertha and remarried, but he never publicly said a bad word about her. And he kept her secrets until the day he died. Bertha Gifford died of a stroke on August 20th, 1951, having spent the last 23 years of her life in the state mental hospital. She had been a model prisoner, first working in the hospital beauty shop and then as a cook. I'll assume any rat poison was kept out of her reach. Eugene had Bertha's body shipped to Pacific, and he paid for a private funeral for her in Morse Mill. She was buried in an unmarked grave in the town cemetery. A short time later, he followed her to the grave and was buried just a few feet away. Bertha, who may or may not rest in peace, is buried between the graves of her two husbands and just a short distance away from at least 8 of the people who died under her care. There are legends that say her spirit haunts the old graveyard, tormented by the proximity of her grave to those of her victims, but there are no firsthand accounts of this. These stories seem to be only a part of local lore. But the cemetery is practically in the shadow of the old Morse Mill Hotel, the same place that had been run as a boarding house by Bertha and her first husband, Henry. If Henry had been her first victim, and evidence suggests that he was, it's likely at the boarding house where she poisoned him. The place, although now closed, empty, and silent, did have a reputation for being haunted for many years. But if Bertha's spirit walked there, as many claimed, she probably wasn't alone. The building dated back to the founding of the village when it was a private home and saw many boarders and guests during its life as a hotel. It survived the Civil War and, if the stories are true, was used by bootleggers during Prohibition. A long list of supernatural happenings haunted the place, from phantom footsteps to full-blown apparitions, and there were plenty of people who believed Bertha Gifford was one of the many spirits that lingered within its walls. Not surprisingly, her former husband Henry was also among them. In 2007, the building was purchased by a contractor who had plans to reopen the place as a small hotel. After renovations began, workmen noticed tools mysteriously disappearing, hearing voices and footsteps on the upper floors even when the place was empty, and being touched on the arm or shoulder when working. Each time they turned to see who was with them, they found they were alone. As work continued, the hotel was visited often by groups and individuals seeking spirits and ghostly activity. As mentioned, the laundry list of haunted happenings was long. It included footsteps and unexplained noises, people having their hair pulled, their clothing tugged, and in a few rare cases, people left with inexplicable marks and scratches on their body. Accounts claim that in addition to Bertha and Henry, as many as 9 other entities remained in the old hotel. Ghostly men, women, and children had allegedly been spotted and even interacted with contractors and visitors over the years. Not all the stories of the Morse Mill Hotel were ever verified, but if even half of them were true, then it was definitely a haunted place. Unfortunately, though, the renovations of the hotel were never completed and the place was shut down. The family that owned it, citing health issues, put it up for sale years ago, but as far as I know, nothing ever went through. And if it's still on the market today, I've been unable to find it. It's been as elusive as the truth about whether the ghost of Bertha Gifford ever walked the hallways of the hotel. If she didn't, there is one other place where her specter might still reside, the so-called House of Mystery. The farmhouse where Bertha and Eugene lived on Old Ben Road still stands today, and for decades there have been claims that it is haunted. Stories have circulated since her death that Bertha has been seen walking in the fields near the house or sitting on the porch. One woman reported driving by the house and seeing a woman in an old-fashioned dress standing outside the open front door, even though no one was living there at the time. Past residents of the house have told stories too. None of them ever claimed to see Bertha's ghost, but she made her presence known regardless, walking back and forth at night, moving things, knocking pots and pans onto the floor, and turning lights on and off. Although generally a nuisance, the resident ghost, who's most likely Bertha, isn't all bad. In one interview, a family who lived in the house said that the front door was locked several times after being left unlatched when they went to bed at night. Once they claimed they'd been away from home when a thunderstorm hit the area and hadn't closed the windows before they left. They returned home expecting to see the house flooded with water, but somehow all the windows had been closed. The doors had all been locked, and none of their neighbors had keys. So if it is Bertha, maybe she's trying to make up for the wrong she committed in life. Before people started dying, people who lived in the area had nothing but good things to say about her, so maybe her spirit is just being helpful these days. All I know is that if I lived in the house, I'd be happy to let her lock the doors, close the windows, and do whatever she wanted. as long as she didn't offer to cook. There's more show to come, so enjoy these delightful messages from our sponsors. Philadelphia recipe. Remind me to never get root beer from Philadelphia.
Yeah, fair enough. Yep. We'll mark that one down.
Jesus. All right. Sorry about that. All right. Now I'm ready now. So
yeah, I'm ready when you are, man.
Okay. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 12 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated this episode and then threatened to poison my producer and co-host if he didn't fix all my mistakes. Of course, that producer is the man, the myth, the legend, Cody Beck.
Hey, thanks. You had me there in the first half, you know, I'm not going to lie. Troy, it's really hot, man.
I know. It sure is. Yeah, it's terrible. I know. It's you're in an old building. I'm in an old building. Parts of my building are cool. My office is not one of them.
Yeah.
And I see you're not in your office, so it must be an oven in there.
I moved my standing desk from my office to my bedroom because how bad it was getting.
Oh, yeah. I thought you got a unit for a window unit.
Didn't get a window unit.
Windows don't do any good anyway.
Didn't get one for the office, yeah, unfortunately. So I just turned my window unit off, which is right next to me off camera. You can't see it, and I'm already starting to feel the impact.
I know. I turned my fan off. I always have a fan blowing right here on my desk. I like the air movement of nothing else, and I turned it off because I thought, I don't want it
through the
whole show. And now I'm starting to sweat. And now we're talking about it, and I'm sweating more.
So we could change subjects.
Yeah, probably should, right?
Yeah, well, what's been going on, dude?
Well, nothing. Getting planned for, what's little left of the summer. At least, I know it's mid-July. So to a lot of people, it's like, well, dude, there's a lot of summer left. But for us, not really, because we're already gearing up for fall. But I've still got some things coming up at the American Oddities Museum this summer. We just posted all of our fall events, so there's just a list of things that are coming up. Dinner tours, Spirits of Alton tours, plus, and I'm just going to read the list real quick. Wyatt Earp, Lizzie Borden, Gangs of Southern Illinois, St. Louis Exorcism, H.H. Holmes, Edgar Allan Poe, The Limp Family, Sinister Hauntings, Possessions, and Poltergeists, Funeral Customs and Traditions, that's our Evening with the Dead, and then our Behind the Museum events. Plus, we have a special event on August 31st that I really can't describe adequately, I don't think, but I'd love to have people there. So if you've seen us post about it, check it out. Along with all those other events I mentioned, just go to dinnerandspirits.com, and that's all you got to do. You can check out everything that's coming up from there.
Nice. So still busy as ever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And believe it or not, you know, I just read that long list, and of course, that's not everything that I do. And I just want you to think for just 1 minute and think all of that stuff is rattling around in his head.
Yeah.
In addition to all the other stuff that's in there, too. So if I forget to plug in a microphone or trip over a cord, now you know why. It's the little things that get away from you.
It's the little, it's the, yeah, the devil's in the details, right? Uh-huh,
exactly.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So,
well, hey, anyway. I'm excited for a lot of those things. We're still rocking and rolling with Patreon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. We're still working on the new season. I've got an episode ready to go. I've got a lot going on the next couple of weeks, in and out, making some moves, which is not as exciting as it sounds at all, because these involve U-Hauls and things and carrying boxes. But I'm ready to go. The next episode's already set for next week. But the Patreon program, we have three full seasons. We have an alternate podcast that we do. You can binge on those three, and we're already deep into season four. We post those, as I mentioned, every other week. So that means that if you're a supporter through Patreon, you get a new show every single week, unless, you know, something dire happens and we don't get a show. But that is only ever happened like once or twice. So anyway, you get a new show, no waiting. So you could check that out if you go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And I highly, highly recommend it, only because I'm having so much fun doing a show about Ed Gein and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I wanted to give a quick shout out to some of our latest supporters on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show. To Nicole, Nikki, Leah, Jody, the lovely Cassidy, Jessica, Whitney, and then since I'm going to read whatever somebody puts on there, shout out to Big Titty Kitty. So thank you very much for supporting the show.
She'll think that's pretty funny. So
yes. Well, we also have other ways people can support the show. So I'd like to read out a listener review real quick.
Oh, okay. Sure.
This one comes to us from Boy Mama 3. It's titled Wonderful Storytelling and Educational and Realistically Creepy. They're talking specifically about Season 4, Episode 6, The Birth of Jazz in the Red Light District from our New Orleans season.
Okay, that's going back.
Yeah, right. It says, question, Troy, when you mentioned that the Red Light District in Chicago was called the Levee, do you think that Don McLean may have been referring to the brothels being closed up? I don't know the history of the song, but that came to my mind when you said that. Thank you for all the great stories. But yeah, do you have any thoughts?
That's interesting, but no, I don't think so. I think he was actually talking about an actual levee, you know, where that holds back the river, because he talks about it being dry. And it wasn't just Chicago that had a levee. Lots and lots of cities did. I'm not sure how that name got started. Actually, nobody does. But it all sprung up sometime around the Civil War. Soldiers who were looking for a good time, you know, on leave, went to the Chicago levee. There was one in St. Louis. I grew up in Decatur, and there was one there. And you'll find red light districts being called the levee, and they probably all stole the name from Chicago. But I don't think that it has anything to do with Don McLean's song. But that's one of those things that I was just talking about with somebody not that long ago. You know, that guy, you know, loves to, I think he just likes to screw with people because he'll like talk about what the song is actually about, and then he will say that's not what it's about. I think he just does it just to mess with people, really, honestly. So I don't even know what half that song is about, but I'm pretty sure he's talking about a real levee like the ones that broke in New Orleans when the hurricane happened in 2005. So
this guy's like guess. The damn Joker. He just wants chaos, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Oh, man. So,
and people just like to watch the world burn.
Exactly. Okay, we're going to talk about a real lovely lady today. I have a lot of questions about this. You know, I've heard of, you know, angels of death, angels of mercy, all these sorts of things. This just seems like it's somebody it has to be a real true compulsion, right? Because you know you have to know you're going to get caught doing stuff
like
this.
Well, you would think so. Right? And, you know, and throughout the episode, I threw in there, you know, there were some people who honestly thought that she meant well, just overdid it because she really didn't know what she was doing. I don't think so. that's just my opinion, but I don't think that's the case. I think that she was sending people on their way. And after a while, it just sort of became a need to do it, I think. I mean, you know, maybe she started off giving people arsenic, thinking it was going to help them. Because, listen, that was the thing. And I mentioned it several times in the episode. People used it for medicinal reasons. For example, there was a woman buried in Bellefontaine Cemetery. Bellefontaine. See, I'm as bad as the rubes. Anyway, you know, who's buried out there in the cemetery because she died from arsenic poisoning because she had used it in her makeup for years and years and years to make her skin paler, because that was a thing. And she died from exposure because people didn't know how dangerous some of that stuff was. Arsenic was one that you found in a lot of different medicines, arsenic and strychnine both. Mm-hmm. You know, they would use it to jumpstart your heart, so to speak. You know, if you were having heart palpitations and things like that. And, you know, it's just like, you know, nitroglycerin pills, same kind of thing, except they finally figured out the dosage in more modern times. But back then, it was thought that maybe, you know, some people suggested maybe she was trying to help people. And I don't know. I'm not buying it.
Neither was the detective who brought her in. Right. His boss might have, but he wasn't buying it. So,
yeah, what would they say? The difference between medicine and poison is the dosage.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, in this case, I think you're right. Well, I think in most cases, you're right, to be honest. So, you know.
Yeah, it was interesting, too, that I guess it's more the killings of, like, you know, opportunity or just kind of whatever comes, because the victims ranged, you know, crazy amounts of ages, age range and male and female, and just that anybody she could maybe get her hands on and had the opportunity.
Yeah, and I think that was more the case, is these were crimes of opportunity because these were people in the neighborhood, within the county, you know, who weren't traveling a long distance, and neither was she to get there. But she would show up at people's house with the idea of, I'm going to nurse them back to health. And here's the thing. She may have killed 17 people, but how many people, we don't know. Nobody kept track of how many dozens of people she nursed back to health. Mm-hmm. So why certain ones? I think that she chose, at least in the beginning, chose her victims because she didn't feel they could recover. Mm-hmm. And so she thought it would be more peaceful for them to die rather than to continue to suffer in agony. And then, of course, there was, you know, like the drunk guy, screw that guy. I want him out of here. Yeah. Or the guy who, started the fight with her. So she poisoned his mother, you know. And so I think that it became a power trip because she realized she had these people's lives in her hands and she took advantage of it eventually. But I really don't think it started that way. I think she thought she was doing them a favor. I don't think she ever thought that, I accidentally gave them too much. No, I think that when she started doing it, it was done on purpose, because I think she started with her first husband, and realized that the power that came with that. And, you know, later on, I think she saw opportunities to give people some peace, or, you know, the way that she looked at it, saw to give them some peace.
Right.
And killed them.
Yeah. So, I wonder.
Mercy killing, as far as she was concerned.
Exactly. You know? I wonder how many serial killers, accidentally kill somebody, get a taste for it, or people that think they want to do it, kill somebody, and then they're like, oh gosh, no, this is absolutely not for me.
Like, I'm sure it happens.
Yeah, you know? That's gotta be.
And I also know that there is a long history of so-called angels of mercy too, people mm-hmm. who think they're helping, you know, whether it be, you know, old people, that's a big one, mm-hmm. or patients that are, you know, terminal, you know, Dr. Kevorkian mm-hmm. type thing. Or I think there's also been a long history of women who've killed infants and things too, that are suffering, that they think can't live or will never have a normal life. They feel like they in their heads, they're doing them a favor. At least that's the excuse they use. And really, I think it's more a case of playing God.
Of course, yeah. And it sounds like, you know, putting people out of their misery by having them go through a lot more misery at first.
Yeah, at first. But hey, you know, it's over with faster that way, maybe. I don't know, man. It's hard to say.
We're trying to do that rationale thing again. Yeah, where it's just not.
I don't think there is one. So
yeah. Oh, I was watching one of my guilty pleasure shows is The Prodigal Son. And it's about a doctor who ended up being a serial killer, and his son is now kind of a detective. It's very cheesy, and I love it.
Yeah, it's too bad. Even if they canceled it after two
seasons.
They
did.
I know.
And I was
just too bad, because I watched it too.
Okay.
Yeah, I was that dude from Walking Dead that played Jesus in The Walking Dead.
Yes.
And I liked it. I mean, it was cheesy, but I watched it. But then they canceled it. So
I was watching it just last night, and one of the things he's saying, I killed, 22 people or whatever, but think about how many people's lives I actually saved. He said, how many people could actually say they had a net positive like that? And I was like, damn it. You know what?
Yeah. I know. Right.
You're right. But also you're not right. But, how do you want to tackle this? We basically know she poisoned a bunch of people.
I mean, I think, I covered it as chronologically as I could by mm-hmm. saying that, things happen, they move to a nice area, and then, after she killed off her first husband, which I'm convinced she did, but moves with a new husband to an area, meets the neighbors. Everybody loves her. She's a great cook, invites people over, is kind to people, then suddenly decides she likes the attention of, nursing people back to health. I mean, she had no skill, no knowledge. She just decided to try it. And, which would have been fine until she started to make up all her own you know, potions and patent medicines and things that were going to, you know, cure all these people's ailments. And God knows what was in them, although we can guess that arsenic was at least one small ingredient, but I think she added more as needed. I think it was kind of one of those case by case basis kind of things. And, you know, after a while of this, of one person after another, or in one case, an entire family.
Yeah,
pretty
right.
Much killed all their kids. And yet the family just always just thought, oh, well, you know, it wasn't her fault. She meant well, which is, again, what kind of brings me back to that thing where, you know, and she's looking and they're asking her at a grand jury, weren't you suspicious? And she's like, well, no, not really. I mean, you know, she was so kind, everybody, and she cared for everybody, which again makes me think of all the people she probably nursed back to health that no one kept a record of, because why would you? You know what I mean? You know, when the law is out to get her, they're just going to track down the cases of people who died. They're not going to look at the people who lived. So I'm thinking that her track record, again, like you just mentioned, was in the net positive. So nobody really, at first anyway, became that suspicious. And besides that, back then, I mean, I know it wasn't that long ago. It was a century ago, but in a very rural area. So if you go to a very rural area in the early 1900s, you got to knock that back 25 years or so when it comes to medicine and on that kind of stuff. So really, you're talking about a long time ago, and you're talking about, you know, an infant and even small child death toll or death rate pretty high.
Yeah.
So little kids, you know, people have 8-10 kids, and then, you know, they decide, well, a couple of them didn't live, and that was to be expected because that was pretty normal back then. So just because several kids from the same family died, it just means that, you know, they were unlucky. You know, they it was bad luck. And that's the way they looked at it, because nobody was really keeping a count on her until she started killing off people who were not sick. You know?
Yeah.
And that's where things got a little tricky.
Yes.
You know, and when that's when people started to raise suspicions, when you had healthy people who, yeah, the dude's got a drinking problem, but he also has a bunch of kids at home and works a good job and takes care of everybody. And otherwise, except for his weekend, you know, drugs,
excursions,
he's in pretty good shape. And now suddenly he drops dead after she takes care of him, you know. And then, you know, the guy that, you know, her and her husband have a falling out with during Prohibition, you know, he was a guy helping Henry out with his still, and now he's dead and his mom's dead. And you're like, okay, you know, somebody's starting to ask questions. And that's when things got iffy.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned too, right before that, there was like, it seemed like 2 years had passed kind of quietly before she starts taking out that family. I wonder if she took a break, but then went a little, you know, berserker mode or something.
Well, or she was taking care of other people and nobody was that sick. And then suddenly along comes this kid who's very sick, and she thinks she's doing a favor to the family by getting rid of some of the mouths they have to feed. You know, we don't know all the details of something because the records just don't exist, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you got newspaper records and stuff, but we don't know what the situation for that family was. We don't know what made her look at that family and think, you know, it would be helpful if they had less kids to feed, or, you know, this kid's really sick, you know, because there was the one girl who had been sick, you know, and she'd been having problems for years. And maybe, you know, Bertha just thought, well, you know, I'm doing this kid a favor. She's never going to be right when she grows up anyway. So why not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Too many angles and too much we just don't know. And it's all tragic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they finally start to kind of piece things together. Grand jury fails to indict the first time.
Because everybody's scared of her.
Yeah, exactly.
By this time, people are scared. You know, they don't want to. Well, because what it had, you know, she loses it on people and they're frightened of her, and she's threatening to sue people and stuff. And, you know, that was one of those things people took very seriously back then, because you don't have a lot of money anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you won a court appeal and you sued somebody for $100. Man, that's probably 3 months worth of salary for some of these guys.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? You're going to keep your mouth shut. And people couldn't prove anything. They only had suspicions. So now nobody was going to talk. They didn't talk until they finally had hard evidence in hand. Once they had those poison lists, which this idiot signed her own name on. I mean, seriously, you're going to kill people with all this arsenic because nobody has that many rats. You're going to kill people with this kind of arsenic. Why would you not go to different pharmacists?
Hubris.
For one thing. Yeah, I guess you just assume that she'd never get caught, or nobody would ever suspect her because everybody loved her, or she just figured, you know, nobody's going to miss these people anyway. Who cares?
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah. And then she has a second grand jury where she is indicted. She kind of not really accidentally confesses, but just didn't think it would really go that far.
Not sure what she was doing when she sat down and just starts telling this detective a story, essentially. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, but we don't know what really all the details of what was said between them.
Yeah.
You know, this is a farm woman who obviously is not super bright because, again, went to the same pharmacist over and over again. So for all we know, he just sort of got her talking, and that's all that he had to do. And so McDonald starts writing down everything she says, because mostly she's complaining about stuff. And then she's talking about how, well, I did this, but I didn't mean anything by it. I was trying to help him, you know, and he's writing it down going, this woman is crazy, you know, and that's what they, you know, started to really dig in and end up with, you know, the evidence from the pharmacists and everything else. And now things are looking pretty bad. I mean, it's aside from the poison logs and her confession, really, this is a very, very circumstantial case, because nobody could prove anything until they dug up a couple of the bodies and then found these lethal doses of arsenic in their livers. You know,
yes.
I think that kind of was the last nail in the coffin there.
Right. And even with her never taking a stand, they eventually changed the plea from.
Right. Well, it didn't matter. Once the judge let in her confession, there was no way to win.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, or when her attorney started to kind of steer things toward, we got to just tell everybody she's crazy.
Yeah.
But obviously she had a mental illness. There's no question about that. I don't think she wasn't a drooling maniac running around. I mean, yeah, she, you know, threatened somebody with a knife, and she was known for carrying around a shotgun, but
who hasn't?
But she wasn't like a raving lunatic. But she definitely had an illness, the same, you know, just like everybody else that gets arrested as an angel of mercy or whatever. She definitely had some issues.
Yeah.
And I think that definitely came out, you know, as all of this stuff came together. And so she probably belonged in a mental institution.
Right.
At least she was off the street. I think that's the main thing. I think that's where you want her, is, you know, with the criminally insane.
Yeah. Where she ends up dying 23 years later.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it seems like ghosts kind of could haunt potentially anywhere and everywhere that they could in this case.
Well, apparently, apparently so, because it gets a little wild. I didn't realize that Bertha Gifford was like the, you know, like Abraham Lincoln of rural Missouri there. But yeah, there's been lots of places that were blamed on, you know, her from that old hotel, which, you know, as I mentioned in this, it's unfortunately, it's not available anymore. People used to go there. We would take a lot of groups there for years.
Nice.
And it was a very popular spot. I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere, really hard to find. But you know, there was a lot of activity. Now, whether it was her or Henry or anybody else from the checkered past to the and very unconfirmed and undocumented past to this place. So it had lots of stories, you know, in air quotes, but how many of them were accurate, I don't know. But there did seem to be a lot of activity around this place. People were you know, constantly having experiences there. And that's always been one of the places that she supposedly haunted. Another one I didn't include, just because there's no record of it at all. It's just been mentioned. But it's not there anymore. So that's another issue. But the insane asylum in Farmington, where she ended up, it was said that her ghost haunted there too. So that would have been honestly number two, or number three would have been the cemetery. You know, again, I can't stand here and tell you that I know that cemetery is haunted either.
Yeah.
But it is there in Morse Mill. It's near the building that used to be the hotel or the boarding house where she had lived and worked for a while, you know, a time. But I also think that her ghost sort of, well, I mean, cemeteries, you know, always get reputations for being haunted, as you know, not always accurately, but it often happens. But she's the most famous person buried there. Well, her and her two husbands and a bunch of her victims who were all buried in the same spot, which is, I mean, you can throw a rock, you can toss a rock and hit like the graves of her victims. And there she is in an unmarked, but oh, you can tell where it is. But the fact that her ghost might haunt that place, that's was attractive to people. And the hotel, just because it had such a reputation of being haunted, you're like, well, why not Bertha? You know, why not her there too? So while it is a haunted place, I assume it still is, even though nobody comes and goes anymore. But I don't know if Bertha was one of the ghosts, but... And I don't know about the asylum, don't know about the cemetery, but if any place that she's haunting, I would say it's her old house, the House of Mystery, which was my favorite. You know, I love it when they come up with these things. You know,
it
reminded me, I was working on the Patreon episode, and there was a somebody in one of the newspapers had called Ed Gein the Plainfield head taker. And I thought, well, that's a new one. Apparently they were just trying that one out.
Yeah.
Because it didn't catch on. But I thought you can always count on the press to come up with something interesting.
Yeah.
And the House of Mystery in this one was like, none of the locals called it that or anything. Some reporter just made it up, but it's a good one. You know, it's a good one. And the house is still there. I mean, it is still there. I've talked to people. Two of those stories came from somebody who had lived in that house. The story about the windows and the story about the, all the things that they would hear in the house and how the door would end up being locked if they left it open at night. So it's almost like, is she trying to make up for what she did in the past, you know, by doing good things now? Maybe she couldn't help herself. She was just mentally ill. I don't know, man. I don't know. She's an interesting character because
absolutely.
You know, it's become quite a legend. A lot of people don't know about it. People who live in the area do. And there are people who will defend her and say it was all accidental. It was a put-up job. None of it was true. And then, of course, there's, you know, reality. And reality says something different, in my opinion. It's an interesting story. And I thought this would be fun, kind of a fun one to include. It's kind of, you know, not in our backyard, but in the backyard. Or the backyard on the other side of the alley, maybe, from us, where we are. And a story that maybe not everybody knows, you know.
So, yeah, and it's always fun, too. Like, I know I've given the press stuff for coming up with cool nicknames before when I say they should call them lame stuff. But sometimes they hit right on the head. Other times, Ramirez was called, like, the screen door intruder first or something.
There was a couple of them. Yeah, there were a couple of them. Before finally the Night Stalker stuck, you know, because, I mean, how do you go wrong with that one?
Exactly.
You know, which wasn't that like an AC/DC song or something? I think
I know he used to wear the shirt all the time, but I can't remember.
I thought it was one of their songs. I don't know.
Yeah, somebody will tweet at us and tell us.
Oh, somebody will let us know, I'm sure. Yeah. So,
oh man, well, that's all I had for Bertha. Okay. Unless you got anything else you want to go over.
I think we're good, man. So, yeah,
all right,
it's a fun episode.
Yeah, well, it is now time for our Ghost Rider segment. So, if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This email comes to us from Charity, and Charity writes, "Hi, I found your podcast a couple months ago and have listened to every episode so far, my favorites being the St. Louis and New Orleans seasons. I tell my friends all the time they should check you out, even if they don't believe in the paranormal, because Troy's way of telling the stories is so good. He can capture anyone's attention in just a few minutes. Anyway, I was wondering if Troy had ever been to the Winchester Mansion and if he's ever thought about doing a series on it. I think it would definitely be a chilling one if so." We haven't talked about that in a long time.
No, but we will.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say. Okay. I mean, so yes, I've been there, and yes, it'll be included in this season, but
all right.
Whenever people get to it, they might be a little disappointed in what I have to say. But anyway, it is coming up this season. So yeah. So just keep listening. We'll get there. So.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been a little while since we've had any controversy that made anybody upset.
It's not that. We'll get there. So
awesome. All right, man. That's all I got.
All right. Well, in addition to emailing Cody, you can also get in touch with us via the Hauntline, which is 217 791-7859, and we might read it on the show. Now, I'm not going to read this one on the show, but it is a reminder that we did ask, I think last episode, we asked for people to get in touch with us about their rewatch movies, a movie that they loved when they were younger that scared the hell out of them, and they went back and rewatched it, and it was either great and just as scary as they remembered, or it was a big letdown, which yeah. I find seems to be more common than anything else. But, you know, I have gotten some of those. Now, we're saving those, though. We're saving them for our Halloween episode this year.
Okay.
But we'd like to start getting some ideas from you guys. So be sure to send those to us. You can email them to us. You can send it to Cody at the email address at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Or you can send them to us on the Haunt Line, and I will save them on here, which is what I've been doing. So, but anyway, I do have a few texts from our last episode. So let me read those off to you. The first one comes from... the 256, and this is one, I don't have a name, but just the 256, this one is makes me feel good. I think it will you too. And it says, thanks for all you do. I love every episode. I am a stuck-at-home dialysis patient. Mm. So kind of, I mean, I'm not going to say we have a captive audience there, but yeah. We kind of do.
Right.
So think of yourself as our captive audience. We just don't have you locked up in our basement or anything. You're just at home. But I am very happy that you are enjoying the show, and we will continue to do our best to keep you entertained as best we can. So
absolutely. Best of luck to you.
And this one comes from the 402. And this one is, says, hello, Tori and Cody. I want to tell you first how much I love the podcast. I've been an avid listener since episode one and loved every season. I am currently working on a book about abandoned cemeteries in Nebraska and across the Midwest in general. I have a couple of questions. Do you know of any family burial grounds in the Midwest which have been abandoned? Oh, gosh, there's tons of them. I'm sure that you're well aware of, you know, Bachelor's Grove. That's off the top of my head. I could think of a few more, but if you email Cody and send it on to me, I can respond probably better in an email. But and two, do you think that those graves or burial grounds, which are forgotten, could end up being haunted? I think there's always that possibility. You know, nobody knows why cemeteries are haunted. They're usually, you know, when you think of just like this season, when you think of a haunted house, you think of it being haunted because, you know, of some tragic or terrible event that happens there. Somebody's murdered, somebody dies suddenly, they commit suicide. But most cemeteries, those kind of things don't happen. I'm not going to say none, but most things like that don't happen. So why are they haunted? And there's been a lot of speculation about that over the years. And some of it, I think, has to do with, you know, maybe the people buried there feel abandoned or alone or forgotten. So maybe that's why they come back as ghosts. I don't know. But it's worth thinking about.
Troy, I actually I was going to have that email. I was going to save it for next time's Ghost Rider.
Oh, do you really?
I'll send it on to you, and you can jot down some ideas.
But this one says, and just to finish it, it says, I had a strange experience when I was cataloging a Pioneer Cemetery in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska. Isn't that everywhere in Nebraska? Anyway, I saw a woman in a period dress standing on the crest of a hill watching me. When I returned to writing for a moment and looked back up, she had suddenly disappeared. So thank you again for the wonderful podcast. I've shared this show with everyone I know. Hope to make it to the conference at some point. Thanks for reading it.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. So, good. I'm glad you got the email. But yeah, I'll definitely take a look. All right, this one comes to us from Ron in the 812, and it says, hey, guys, love the show. I've been following Troy's exploits since his days guesting on Ghostly Talk, and that was before it was a podcast. There were no podcasts. They were an internet radio show, one of the very first ones, as far as I know, at least as far as ghosts go. Anyway, here's the question. If you could stay overnight in any house in America you've not stayed in yet, which would it be? I think for me, it would be the White House for all the presidential ghosts that have been seen around there. I would agree with that. I would say the White House would be a cool place to spend the night in, a place I haven't yet. And there's probably other ones, but that's one that would be on the top of my list too. I've got a presentation next weekend on Abraham Lincoln. And so I was kind of revising it and adding some things in. And I was working on the whole White House being haunted by Lincoln section, which was a lot of fun. And I thought, you know, it'd be so cool to stay there. I don't know. Can you stay there when no one else is there? Can you stay like in between people? Do we have a overlap there somewhere?
Yeah.
I don't want to hang out with any there. And there's been a few, but I can't go back in time. Yeah, I would love to go hang out there with, you know, Harry Truman or something. That'd be a ball, you know, it'd be a blast. You could just sit up, drink beer all night, you know, but most of these guys, I don't hang around with these people, you know, anyway, politicians suck. Anyway. All right. So this one comes from the 847. It says, "Hey guys, I'm a little late listening to the Rouse murders episode. I would have been a very little girl when those occurred. My mom's friend was a realtor, still is, in Libertyville. And she said at the time that part of Milwaukee Avenue, where the mansion was located, was very rural." That is accurate. Subdivisions haven't really been built up yet. She said the house was strange, with lots of secret passages, as we talked about in the episode. And the property it was on was just plain creepy. After college, I worked at a company just down the road, and I remember where the mansion was. This would have been the late 90s. And I distinctly remember there being lots of Lake County police cars, about seven, seeing them all after work. They were out with flashlights looking for something on the property. Was it something paranormal or a body? Who knows? I just thought I would share. Love your show, as usual. Yeah. So, all right, two more. And we are wrapping it up. All right. Hello from California. This one comes from the 805 California. Hello, California. I've been listening since the Murdered in Their Bed season, and it's been a staple podcast ever since. It's great to get the research and narrative and conversational insight all in the same podcast. Thank you, Troy and Cody, for working to make such a great show. So that was really just an ego stroke.
I love it.
And this comes from Eddie in the 678. It says, "Hey guys, how's it going? Greetings from Georgia. Troy, I was wondering, which of your books is your favorite?" I don't have any. The one I'm working on right now is always my favorite, because as soon as I'm done with it and it's on its way to be edited and everything else, I move on to the next one. So it's always my favorite. Now, there have been some I liked writing more than others, but I don't have a single one. But here's a question to put you on the spot. Cody, which of Troy's books is your favorite? Well, he doesn't know, because he's never read any of them.
The Devil and All His Works.
Oh, that is true. I guess I did know that one. I take that back. So anyway, I hope you guys are keeping cool from the summer heat. Guys are my number one podcast. So thanks a lot, man. And thanks, Eddie. I know who Eddie is. Right? We both do.
I love if you could see my first Haunted Alton book and my Haunted St. Louis books, and how they have so many tabs and notes and highlights and everything. And then we get to Murder to Their Beds, and that starts and then it stops.
Because
you give me all these great outlines. I don't need to like do my own research beforehand, and it just became so tedious. So I have every book for each season, and I'll reference them.
But, I'm just kidding you.
Oh, no. I think it's hilarious. But also I wanted to say, I still haven't been to Villisca, so that'd be my choice as a place to stay overnight.
Yeah, I have. Thing still. It was recently purchased by a commercial operation.
Oh yeah. Got it.
I can't really say anything because I can't judge it firsthand because I've not been there since. Mm-hmm. I just know how it used to be.
Yep.
And I don't think I want to screw up my memories of how it was with.
Fair enough.
What it might be now. It's very different than it used to be. That's really all I can say. Mm-hmm. And I said I can't judge it. I haven't been there, but I'm not, from what I've seen and what I've heard, I'm not feeling fantastic about it. But
I got it.
We'll see.
I still have a DVD of yours, I believe, of some footage from when you guys were
From the closet.
Yeah, it's wild.
That is wild.
It is really cool.
Yeah, it's a very weird. That was a very weird night there at the house. I think honestly, except for a couple, and I've been there, I don't know, a couple of dozen times, and all but just a handful, something weird was going on.
Yeah,
every time. Every time. So, I have slept, but I've never slept in the beds. It's too weird.
Yeah.
And I know they're not the real beds. I know they were just period pieces brought in to, you know, kind of fill the space.
Yeah.
To look like the original beds. But even so, I could never sleep in one of the beds. I always slept on a sleeping bag on the floor. So, but no thanks. Anyway. All right. Well, I guess we can wrap this up. Yep. So, guys, thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. Share the show with your friends, your neighbors, anyone you know. If you like the show, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like the show, why are you still listening?
Yeah.
Anyway, you can send us an email. You got questions, comments, whatever, to the email address that we listed earlier, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. Or you can drop us a text on the Haunt line at 217-791-7859. You can also, am I in your part? No, I'm not.
No.
You can also check us out on social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. Also, don't forget, use the discount code podcast when shopping for books, tours, events, whatever, at AmericanHauntings.net or at Cody's shirt store, which is AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. And you can use the code there too. It's just podcast, and you get 10% off everything you order.
Awesome.
All now right. It's your turn. Now
thanks.
It's your turn.
Thanks,
sorry, I it seemed like I was going on too long and I just wasn't stopping and I couldn't figure out why. But then as I looked a little bit closer, I saw Cody in capital letters on there. So my intensive script here, which is not really very intensive. Anyway, sorry, it's your turn.
Yeah, no, so this episode of the American Onyx Podcast, I see what you're doing, was written and performed by Troy Taylor. It was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links.
Stop reading that part. It contains show notes and links.
And links. Thanks again
and
for
photographs that go with some of the episodes.
Some of them. We couldn't, definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, don't forget to send your movie review things. But
Sorry. Damn it. I did the wrong thing.
See you later.
Man.
Yeah.
Bye, guys.
We tripped not only at the finish line, but throughout the whole thing. So I think it's totally fine.
All right. See you guys. Later. See ya.
Good to end on a great note.